Some experts in municipal law have raised questions whether the Bloomington City Council move to strip the mayor's power to put items on the agenda is legal. Lori Riverstone Newell is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. She tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker that the first city manager form of government appeared in Virginia in 1908 as part of the urban reform movement. Riverstone Newell says the move toward a city manager form of government was part of a larger progressive movement of the time.
The idea behind that was to have a very, very weak mayor and an empowered council that would be both legislative and political, with a city manager then hired and serving at the pleasure of the council. And so the weak mayor part of that was just to provide a figurehead for the city. And most of the time, the mayor would just be rotated, you know, on an annual basis out of those council members. We had just left a really corrupt period of time in our cities in America where we had machines running our cities, and there was very little accountability. There was very little control over cost of service provision. And what we were trying to do in the reform movement was to come up with a way to correct for this, too.
And over time, the variations on the theme arose. How did those come to be?
Yeah, the first attempt was that city, that council manager system. And the idea was to not have one strong central figure. And during the machine era, it was the machine boss that was the strong central figure. So if we took the powers of the city and we diluted that across several people, the idea then was that we wouldn't be able to see the level of corruption. They would check one another. And that council manager system worked. It did. It introduced, you know, business style government, and efficiencies followed with lower costs for services and with a more directed agenda. And so that was great. There's a interesting little transition over time where you see the reemergence of strong mayors, though. We got used to the idea of, or maybe we lost our fear of, a strong central figure or authority in the executive position following the Great Depression. FDR came in, and he was seen as someone who really saved the cities, someone who was working directly with cities. And we saw that a strong central government, but also a strong central figure in the executive office, could be a good thing. And so around the 1950s, we saw strong mayors coming back into vogue. What's really interesting about that is that, you know, while some strong mayors had survived through the urban reform movement, there's an academic, his name is George Frederickson, and he says that somewhere also around the 1950s, we saw a very slow, quiet adaptation of our city governments, where we had corrected for a lot of the inefficiencies and corruption in the early period, early 1900s, with that city manager position. But around the 1950s and 60s, we also needed a political figurehead, someone who could unite the city and someone who could bring a cohesive agenda to the table. And that caused us to turn toward bringing in mayors and giving them more power, even in a system that already had a city manager. You know, someone to be able to manage equity issues and to be able to drive economic development in a cohesive and manner. And, you know, people want that. They want the political representation and they want that administrative efficiency at the same time. And that's why we have, on paper, a system that looks very different from what we have in reality. State law only allows for certain types of structure of local governments. You have to pick. And you can pick a strong mayor council style. You can pick a commission style. Only 1% of our cities do that. And you could also pick, you know, a council manager style. And if you have to check one box, then you're going to pick, you know, maybe a council manager style. But in truth, you'll also be electing a mayor. There's a reason for this. This shift happened because we want oversight. We want transparency. We want accountability. We want administrative efficiency. We want all of these things, and you can't find them in these really rigid structures as they are written on paper. So what did we want when we moved more toward a strong mayor style of government, when we started bringing that back in? We wanted someone to speak for all of us. We wanted to make sure that equity was being addressed. And that's really hard to do in a pure ward style or council manager style government. because you're not going to have, one council member may represent a very poor part of town, for instance, or the city, and that's one vote. Who can, if not the mayor, come back in and say, we have to look at this? I think we as a people very smartly began to call upon our governments to do more for us in various ways that aren't reflected necessarily on paper.
In any college public administration class, you're going to get a lesson or a lecture at some point on the dangers of the power of expertise and how staff can run roughshod over elected office holders simply because they have more information and can tailor it. Has there been that sort of excess with city managers from time to time?
Absolutely. Yeah, the idea was that city managers would take care of that political or partisan corruption that we saw in our local governments. And we found very quickly that city managers were also political creatures. And in fact, we've seen some cases, and I love city managers. I'm not trying to knock them off their position, but we've seen some cases where city managers have actually worked to try to get council members or mayors elected or to try to unseat them from time to time. And obviously, if they're the ones that are asking to add things to council agendas, then they are the ones that have the political pull in a lot of areas of the city functions. And so people go to them.
Well, in the city of Bloomington's case, the proposal is to take the agenda-setting power away from the mayor, mm-hmm. or reduce it, rather, to that of just another council member, mm-hmm. and to have five out of the then nine council members plus the mayor people sign a petition to put something on the agenda. It had been four, and then the mayor had a sole agenda-setting power. How does that work usually across the spectrum?
If you have a strong mayor, then that mayor typically has the power to add items to the agenda. Most of our cities that are large in the United States, our larger cities, do have a strong mayor in place, and they typically run the show. In this case, you do have a city manager who should be adding items to the agenda. You do have your council members who, can come together and add items to the agenda. Mayor Renner should have the power to add items to the agenda. He represents the whole city and nobody else does. If that's the case, it seems to me like by taking away that power, we're regressing back to an old ward system, an old ward style government where you have fragmented oversight of your city functions. And, somebody needs to speak for everybody. We have an elected mayor, and we've asked for someone to do that. We elected that mayor to take that role.
What is the structural effect of making the mayor just one of 10 votes rather than having the mayor have that power? Does that elevate the primacy of the city manager's agenda-setting power?
I doubt it. What is being attempted is to actually reduce the power of the mayor's office and to cede that power over to the council members themselves.
If you need five signatures, does it reduce the likelihood that some important issues will be addressed at all because of a political reluctance to do the tough things?
Sure, absolutely. And if you have, let's call them cliques within the council, where you have just the right number that are taking care of each other, you can reduce the power of the other council members too. There's a real need for someone to be able to say, hey, we really need to look at this. And if you take away the mayor's ability to add items to the agenda, we lose that oversight, that wider vision, if you will. And, on top of that, too, I think it's really important to realize that there's a lot of hostility between, at least traditionally, there's been a lot of hostility between the mayor's office and this council. And this is a political move. This isn't in my opinion, it's not for the betterment of the council. I've not heard, if Mayor Renner were adding, tons of items to council meetings and, running the agenda off the road, not being able to deal with things that council members you know, feel like should be dealt with, then that'd be one thing. But that's not what I've heard. You know, I've heard that this is a political move to try to reduce the mayor's power just generally.
The council's been a little reticent in making the case. They've talked about having a more cooperative environment, but they haven't made the case for change.
No, I don't think so. The case that I've heard is that, you know, I think in one case I heard there's a shortage of staff, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense with changing this power of the mayor, but also just that there's a lot that needs to be done and we need to focus. And, you know, that's interesting. If it's true that the mayor is coming in and introducing all sorts of things to the agenda and they're not able to accomplish these goals that or needs that the city has, then that's one thing. I haven't heard that. What I've heard is that you've got, in particular, one alderman, Alderman Sage, who's interested in just, you know, putting the mayor in his seat and has enough support from other council members that that may actually be accomplished. I do think it's interesting, though, that the mayor will retain the ability to call special session and to be able to control the agenda in that special session. And so what might happen then is if the mayor doesn't have the ability to modify the agenda or add to the agenda of regular council meetings, that he may be forced then to call extra special sessions to be able to introduce some of these larger citywide goals.
That's kind of a heavy-handed mechanism, though.
They'd be forcing him into it. Or he can choose then to fall in line with what the council wants and serve as just another, you know, council member in many ways. That's not what the public elected. But he could just say, okay, you know, the council's spoken, I'll sit down and I'll just be another voting member. I don't see that happening.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Lori Riverstone Newell, a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University, specializing in state and local government structures. What is the breakdown nationwide of strong mayor versus weak mayor, city manager versus strong mayor forms of government?
Yeah. So what we have is most of your cities now with a population of 50,000 or more have a council manager style government on paper. And most of your cities that are larger or smaller than 50,000, larger by that I mean over a million with population, or smaller than 50,000 people do have a strong mayor style of government.
Why the big ones and the itty-bitty ones having the same and then the mid-sized ones going with city manager? Did that happen?
I think it has to do with growth. If you've got cities that are smaller than 50,000, the idea of having the efficiencies that are supposed to come with city managers just really isn't on the agenda. They don't need someone that can quickly move the city forward because they're not really growth oriented yet. You know, once you hit around 50,000 people, then things start to change pretty quickly. Either you're going to grow or you're going to regress in your population, and you may then fill the need to put the money toward a city manager, and they're not cheap. In those larger cities, you know, with a million people or more, then what they found is if you have a true council manager system where you don't have a strong mayor in place, then it just gets really complicated and it gets slowed and bogged down because you have various council members representing various areas of the city, and to be able to pull them together and come up with one agenda is just complicated and difficult to accomplish.
This brings up the actual ward structure of the city of Bloomington. A few years ago, then Alderman Rob Fazzini suggested moving to a hybrid system of some elected at-large city council members and some ward city council members. The knock on city councils with wards has been that parochial thinking is encouraged and just ward-only issues get attention, and the larger strategic issues for the entire city are not as likely to be subject to large-scale time investment by council members. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. In some research, what we found is that in some cities, if you have ward-based systems, more of an unreformed political system, then you do have better political representation. And I'm going to put a caveat on that. But the reason why they found that is because having at-large systems oftentimes dilutes the ability of minority groups to be heard. It can be beneficial to minorities because if you do have a ward that's largely minority, they can find representation, find a voice in the system. And it does make sense then to have a few members that are elected at large I kind of like the hybrid system. I think it's true that the town of Normal is all elected at large, and I think that we could argue that without having a very aware and active council, that there would be some groups whose voices would be swallowed up in that larger city agenda.
Well, speaking from experience, the dissent in the town of Normal is not often. So is there a danger of groupthink when you have everyone at large?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you're thinking at a higher level of abstraction, if you will. You're taking a top-down perspective and looking at the entire city and what's good for all of them without having to necessarily respond to various groups within.
Are there negative trade-offs with a hybrid system?
I don't think so. I think that a hybrid system makes a lot of sense. And I want to relate that back to what's going on with Terry Renner's situation. If you have a hybrid system, then you allow for your voices within those various wards or districts to be heard. And that's a good thing, in my opinion. You want to have somebody close to home to know what you need and to be able to represent you in council. If you couple that with at-large elected members, then you also have this larger oversight, this view that's taking a couple steps up the ladder, and to be able to balance the voices and try to come up with some system of government that looks at individuals and also the needs of the whole city. In the case of Bloomington, what you have is all, you know, ward representation. And if they go back and they remove the power of the mayor to have, you know, to place items on the agenda, then you're really taking away the ability to have that, you know, larger city voice, the cohesive voice that we need to drive city politics as a whole forward. If Bloomington had a few at-large elected members, I would be less negative on what they're trying to accomplish.
Is it even legal to change the mayor's power to set agenda items under the current structure?
I think it is in a very weird way. The way I understand it is that it would not be legal to take away his power to veto. It would not be legal for them to take away his power to call special session. That has to go before a referendum. I think that there's some debate whether or not council has the ability to take away his power to add items to the agenda. But the way that it looks like that the municipal code is written, they may actually be able to accomplish it. Would then Mayor Renner have the ability to come back and take maybe some kind of legal action? I think so. So, I mean, it just depends. It depends on how much he wants to press. And, I mean, he's not a...
a shrinking violet?
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. He's not a shrinking violet. I don't see him sitting back and just letting this happen. So what does that mean? It means that the council is opening itself up and opening the city up to litigation. Now, come on, you know, is that a proper use of public money? And I would say that there might be other ways to accomplish what they want without taking away the power of the mayor and without opening up the city to some expensive litigation in the future. I think that they need to recognize the law as it stands and the norms across the nation, that being that the mayors have the ability to add items to the agenda. And I think that they need to figure out how to work within that system. You know, this is a political contest, you know. This is a struggle for power and a struggle for some kind of rearrangement of authority within government. And you have to ask yourself why. And barring any good reason, that being that Mayor Renner is trying to take over the whole show and trying to dilute the power of the council somehow, this is something that they need to learn to work within.
And structurally, he can't do that, though.
No. I mean, there's so many checks in the system. And frankly, his ability to add items to the agenda is a check in the system. You know, if you want to dilute the power of the mayor's office, then that has to be, that's not like that power disappears, the power shifts, you know. So who gets the power that's taken away? And that goes directly to the council.
Alderman David Sage, who made the proposal to keep the mayor from placing items on the agenda, has not answered GLT's request for comment. The proposal could return to council attention on December 11th. This is Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.